Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
皆様こんにちは。ウィトリージョン担当です。今日も日本の歴史に飛び込むポッドキャストを発表いたします。前回と少々違ってタイムラインの枠を生かしてイギリスの歴史も日本の歴史も発表いたしたいと思います。
I'm joined by British history specialist Bo Date, and together we're going to cover 700 years of British and Japanese history from 800 to 1500 AD. Now that's a long time, two countries. It's going to be a bit of a wild ride. We've set ourselves a bit of a challenge here, but for most people in the West who don't have any information about early Japanese history, you should come out of this podcast with a rough picture of the important developments, I think, in Japan during this time. I think most people in the West have a better understanding of British history, but again, the details usually get lost in the generalizing, don't they? So without further ado, let's jump in. And it's not straight at 800 AD. Let's start at 794 AD, because this is when the Heian period of Japan starts. Now, Japanese history is divided into several eras or periods. There's the Jomon period, the Kofun period, the Asuka period, the Nara period, and then the Heian period. And I start here because before then, it's all about taxes and Buddhism, and I get terribly bored. but now with Heian, we start to get things like literature and samurai and wars and battles, and it's stuff I can get more excited about. So 794, signifying the start of the Heian period, is when the emperor, Kanmu, the 50th emperor of Japan, moves the capital from Nara, just down the road, to Kyoto. And this is a big thing because the capital remains Kyoto for many hundreds of years afterwards. And it's called the Heian period, I believe, because of that is essentially the name of the new capital, Heian-kyo, that he creates. But this is in 794. And what's happening in Britain at this time?
Well, we're just about to be treated to the first big Viking raids. Mm-hmm. Perhaps the most famous one is Lindisfarne in 793. Mm. So it's very contemporaneous with what you're talking about. I hope this is really good. If people don't know, John is our resident Japan expert. You've lived there, haven't you?
Yes, and,
So you know it very, very well. Now, my history, although I like to think of myself as sort of an all-rounder, of course, there are blind spots. And for me, one of them is Japan.
Right.
I know some of the, I know most of sort of the big things, but not much detail. Certainly sort of 9th century Japan, I know very, very little about. So hopefully, I'm going to genuinely learn stuff here. I'm actually quite looking forward to it.
Excellent.
And the stuff that I'm going to do is sort of going over the same old things. Like, for example, Lindisfarne, anyone that knows about the English, the Dark Ages, and the Dane law, and the men of the North, the Norsemen and the Danes coming over. Lindisfarne is sort of a big, it's sort of a big set piece thing where it's sort of, it's not, it's obviously not the first raid remotely, but it's sort of one of the big, it's one of the first big ones where they came over, and there was a monastery at Lindisfarne with monks there.
And lots of wealth then.
Yeah, and there was a fair bit of money there because the church, of course, before any sort of Protestant Reformation or anything like that, there was no sort of injunction against having gold and silver and bejeweled things. So a monastery could be extremely rich. It's certainly a place worth raiding. So that's kind of a key date in the sort of Dark Ages, mm-hmm. sort of the pre-conquest.
And these Viking raids, they go on for literally hundreds of years, don't they? They're an absolute scourge on the people who are just trying to have a peaceful life in England at this time.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. It goes on and on and on. Well, after Lindisfarne, mm-hmm. the popular idea in sort of the minds of the Anglo-Saxons, mm-hmm. I mean, even saying that is problematic, but was that, well, we can't allow this to keep going on. And so under Alfred and his successors, they decided to sort of try and put together sort of a formal defence and start levying monies in order to make what would be a proto-navy. Mm-hmm. I mean, much later, hundreds of years after this, we've got a thing called scutage. Mm-hmm. It was where the kings would sort of levy money from their knightly class in order to pay for a navy, really, or a very, very small navy, to try and keep the Danes out or at least baffle them in any way possible. Mm. But even that is sort of in the future. Mm. So around 800 odd, we start getting the big, big invasions. And of course, it culminates in Canute in the 11th century. But getting ahead of ourselves a bit, why don't you tell us all about what's going on in Japan around the year 800?
To be honest, roughly. It's still a little quiet in Japan at the moment. So I thought we'd talk a bit more about Alfred and go up to, I think, the Battle of Maldon.
Okay. Yeah, no, happy to. So the Battle of Maldon is 991. Mm-hmm. Again, it's sort of a key, fairly key one, key battle.
But let's just talk about Alfred. Why is Alfred the Great? Like, why do we call him the Great?
Right, okay, because he was the first king, really, to sort of undeniably, successfully push back against the Danes. Mm-hmm. Most historians don't really call them Vikings much anymore. Mm. The word Viking came from the word, people argue about that even, comes from the word to mean pirate, really, or it could even be a verb,
right?
To go a Viking. Means to go and raiding
across
the seas.
We're going Viking on Friday night.
Yeah,
do you want to join
yeah.
us?
Okay. So to call them all Vikings is a bit low resolution. Mm. But to be fair, we called the people from modern day Denmark, mm-hmm. or quite often just Danes, people from modern day sort of Sweden and Norway, they were often just called Norse, or the Norsemen, mm-hmm. or the men of the North, or all those different words like that. England, there was no England as such. And there was all sorts of different kingdoms. Mm-hmm. So the Angles and the Saxons and the Jutes had all come over from mainland Europe. Well, Saxons are from Saxony, which is obviously modern day Germany. Mm-hmm. But the Angles and the Jutes are from, you know, that part of the world as well. And they've kicked out the Britons all hundreds of years before this. Mm. So by the year roughly 800, there's many kingdoms in England. There's Kent, East Anglia, Wessex, Northumbria, mm-hmm. a few different ones. Famously, there were seven kingdoms at one point, but that's a window in time. Mm. Anyway, the Danes come over and they take York.
Yep.
They called it Jarvik. And so for a long time, for hundreds of years, there's like this Dane law in sort of northern England. And if you were to look at a map, if you can imagine a time-lapse type map, mm-hmm. you would see that the Dane law, in other words, the land that is controlled by the Danes, it would grow and shrink lots and lots of times over those generations. It's not a very static thing. For example, just one example is at one point, one of our kings had taken back most of it. And then there was the king of Dublin, who's also a Viking, is also a Dane. It was like Olaf Gustafsson or something like that. It's like not an
Sounds
Irish
like
name.
A Norse name,
right,
it?
Exactly. He was like the king of Dublin at the time. Came over and reconquered that off of us, and then we took it back again, and on and on and on. Mm-hmm. So it's the Dane law grows and shrinks, ebbs and flows quite heavily, really. But Alfred,
it must have been very bloody and terrible for the people involved. Constant war, borders moving backwards and forwards, not even really existing in the modern sense.
Yeah, it's a very confusing picture, and you can only imagine that it's messy.
Yes.
You know, I think that's a good way of describing it, messy, because it seems to have been very bloody. And, you know, like the Angles and the Saxons were themselves invaders.
And that really contrasts with Japan in a sense, because we've got this chaos and this mess, this lawlessness there. Whereas in Japan, things are largely stabilized following the Nara period. You've got Kyushu, Shikoku, and much of Honshu being occupied under the rule of the emperor, who is widely regarded as the emperor. You have the integration of Chinese classics and Buddhist thought into the administration of this slightly Confucian state. And while, of course, there are uprisings, rebellions, or ran, as they call them in Japanese, every now and again, things are more or less quite well settled at this period in time.
The whole islands of Japan, you could say.
Yeah,
that
so the rule of the emperor doesn't extend right up to Hokkaido. There is an area inhabited by the Emishi, or northern barbarians, and Hokkaido itself is still occupied by the Ainu, who are another tribal people, much like the Inuit, actually, still exist in some form to this day. So it's not quite... the emperor hasn't spread his rule over the whole island, but there is still this polity, which is unquestionably the strongest polity in Japan, which rules most of the area that we know as the four islands of Japan.
So that is different to England same time.
Yes. Yeah, another thing that's also worth mentioning before I forget, sorry to cut you off, is that the population of Japan is much, much larger than England at this point.
Really?
And it is for a long time throughout history. In fact, when Japan was finally discovered by Europeans in the sort of around the 1500s, it has a population that's roughly equivalent to France, Spain, England, Italy combined. It's enormous. And the reason for this is rice agriculture in early Japan enables them to essentially set up an agricultural civilization with a head start over the Europeans. They don't have the terrible wars and civil wars that we have in Europe and the plagues which decimate the population. And so they're able to actually grow quite a large population in these relatively small islands.
That's interesting, because they've got a larger population than us now, significantly more.
Double,
I believe. Yeah. Right, yeah. Which is interesting because, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but can you say that Japan it's not the best for sort of arable
land? It's mostly mountains, isn't it?
So obviously there's rice paddies, obviously, but I've also heard one of the tidbits I know about sort of medieval or ancient Japan is that they is one of the examples of a civilization in the world that was able to get so much of their sustenance from the sea that for example, a steppe civilization or one of the steppe peoples, like I'm just randomly off the top of my head, the Avars.
Right.
They just couldn't. Obviously, they just couldn't sustain themselves in that way.
Mm.
They would have to be either sort of nomadic huntsmen or settle down and start working, tilling the land. Whereas Japan's different. They could get so much of their energy from the ocean that they're able to sustain such a massive population.
Absolutely. Right. And it's quite remarkable, because you often don't realize this when you're just studying the history and the laws and the reforms and so on. But actually, when you just think about the population, the geography, there is quite a remarkable story just written into that alone.
One thing I want to say is that, of course, this is a bit of an overview episode and a comparison type episode, so something a little bit different. We want to keep it tight on England and Japan. Mm. But there is one thing to say: in the year 800, Charlemagne is crowned. And of course, that's a big thing, because there's a couple of things I've got here where it's not sort of strictly just England, but it is really important, like the Black Death, for example. It affects us. And so I think it's really interesting when you look at what's going on at other places in the world. So the age of Charlemagne is... So, you know, that puts in some perspective. People know about the Holy Roman Empire and the Franks, and the various Frankish kingdoms and things.
Mm.
I once visited the Sutton Hoo site, and there was a big exhibition thing, and it had a timeline there, what was going on in other places in the world at the point of King Radwald and the Sutton Hoo treasures. Mm-hmm. One of the things it sort of pointed out was that the Hagia Sophia, was being built around that time, roughly speaking. And of course, as great as the sort of Anglo-Saxon burials are of that age, and mm-hmm. sort of
they're
fantastic.
Nothing on the Hagia Sophia.
Yeah, yeah, it's still a whole. It's yeah,
it's still orders of magnitude.
A little bit pathetic in comparison, uh-huh. almost. You know, mm. I think that's fair to say. I don't mind saying that. And it's just interesting to see that. So, for example, Japan's a lot more stable politically, if nothing else. Yeah.
But you could say that that's partly due to the mountains, the geography. It's a well-known fact that it's hard to wage war across a mountain, whereas in Britain, relatively flat land, you have the Vikings and the Danes and the Saxons duking it out on the borders of the Danelaw and leading up to the Battle of Maldon.
Right, yeah. So we're missing out nearly 200 years there because it's 991 Maldon. Mm. But what Maldon represents, what Maldon is where the Danes, I'm just going to call them Danes, they're not just raiding. They've been doing a bit more than raiding for quite a while. Yeah. They send over small populations that are meant for settling. Mm. But what they hadn't really done is sent over full-blown professional armies.
Right.
Okay. Right? You know, because the Vikings are sort of, they're more raiders, really, usually. I keep switching between saying Vikings
I think
and
the viewers
Danes.
Understand what
yeah,
we mean.
Understand. But in 991, they've sent over, and Maldon's in the south, they sent over a full-blown army.
Wow.
That was met by an English, because sometimes some of their raiding parties were as big as an army, but then we never sort of met them in a pitched battle. Mm-hmm. Well, there were some smaller ones, but Maldon's the big one. Maldon's the one where historians can point to and say, right, the Danes have sent over a full-blown army-sized contingent. We've raised a full-blown army of our own, and we meet in this battle. And the thing about it is we lost.
Right.
The Danes won that one. Mm-hmm. And so historians will point to that and say, oh, well, that's something like the beginning of the end. Mm. Because that period, you can say, culminates in Sven Forkbeard and his son Canute utterly winning, completely taking all the kingdoms of England and just completely winning and dominating.
And Canute had a huge empire, which included England and Denmark and other territories besides, didn't
he? Yeah, he was one of the most powerful over-kings in all of Europe. Mm. Absolutely. Certainly northwestern Europe, he was absolutely dominant. But that's a few generations after Maldon, a couple of generations after Maldon. But historians, you can look back at something and say, ah, there was the seed of... Apparently, the English were extremely overconfident. We just assumed that we had God on our side. Yeah. We've always sort of smashed them to bits when we'd needed to in the past. Mm-hmm. And it's not really explained very well because our sources are quite poor. But the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles say that we were massively overconfident, assumed we would win, and then on the day get beaten and get beaten convincingly. Mm. And so our sort of military power, at least for a while in the south, was really quite badly weakened. Mm-hmm. So that's why the Battle of Maldon is sort of quite important.
But you mentioned about sources there, and I just want to point out that, again, there's a difference in the sources here. So the Japanese sources tend to weave literary and poetic ideas and religious ideas very strongly into what they're talking about. And so the challenge for a historian is to then unpick, well, this guy probably wasn't like 20 feet tall and had... 3-inch long teeth, and that's probably not true, but was he a real historical figure, and was he, and so on and so forth.
Right.
And as we approach the turn of the millennium, we have a huge flourishing in literature and culture in Japan. This is really where, if you study the Heian period, you'll generally study Heian literature. There are two main pieces of literature which come out of this. There's The Pillow Book by Seisho Nagon, which comes out in 1002. And there is Genji Monogatari, or The Tale of Genji, which you may have heard of. It's more well known, by Murasaki Shikibu. And these are very influential pieces of Japanese literature for the reason that they're written in a kind of kana. So the Japanese language, as we know it today, is essentially three alphabets. You have kanji, which is the Chinese characters or Chinese-looking characters. Then you have two alphabets. One of them is katakana and the other is hiragana. Now, the distinction between katakana and hiragana happens many, many centuries later. And up until then, people tend to mix them up.
But it's very easy to write in katakana because it is, or hiragana, because they are like an alphabet. They're a syllabary, right. Technically. Each symbol represents a syllable. However, that gives you a way of writing things down without having to know thousands and thousands of Chinese characters. Right. And it was seen as quite feminine because if you look at this, or if you've seen Japanese writing, it's quite curvy and loopy and so on. And they saw that as feminine at the time. Well, both Sei Shonagon and Murasaki Shikibu were women. They were noble women, and they were writing, and Genji Monogatari is essentially, it's like a soap opera about a prince in the court of Japan who spends most of it just going around traveling Japan looking for a wife or a concubine or whatever it may be. And so there's really no attempt to tell a serious story, but people regard it as the first novel because it really talks about the human condition and the psychology and so on. It's very rich with cultural references, with poetry, for example. Another two pieces of literature which are worth mentioning around the 1000-year mark in the Heian period, there is Ochikubo Monogatari, which is the Japanese Cinderella. And it's almost the same story, remarkably enough. It's about a woman who is bullied by her stepmother and eventually marries a handsome prince.
Right. Wow.
It's quite simple, but it's amazing how intrinsic that kind of story is.
Sounds like it predates Cinderella as well, massively.
Indeed, at this period. And then finally, one thing I want to mention is the lyrics of the Japanese national anthem were written at this point. Yeah. And in the edit, we shall put in a clip of that. But
that's extremely old, isn't it?
They're arguably the oldest lyrics of any national anthem.
Right. Oh, I can believe that.
It's very short, but very impactful. So really, a lot of the literary traditions in Japan trace back to this period, to the Heian period. And that's why many people studying, say, Japanese studies at university, their teachers will plant them firmly in the Heian period and say, right. Look, this is where it all started.
Right. In a way. That's very interesting. You mentioned the first novel, their first Japanese novel, because some literary critics like to say the Odyssey is the first Western novel, which obviously is, it's deep in the long ago, isn't it? We don't know the exact date, but there are
many arguments, of course, over the definition of what a novel is.
Right, yeah, some could say, you could say Gilgamesh is a novel, and others say no, and the novel is a sort of a 18th, 19th century construction. Mm-hmm. But it's a funny word, the novel, it really means.
The people who define it more along the later lines, the 17th century, 18th century, I think they associate more with Genji Monogatari as being an early novel because it is that kind of person drama, almost like a Jane Austen or a Charlotte Bronte, that it centers around this small elite caste and dwells on their human problems rather than trying to attempt great things.
So that was one thing I did want to ask you about, so that it's not strict history. It's not like someone's proactively thinking, I want to record the past or record events of my lifetime for future generations. It's not that.
There is some of that chronicling as well, but I should have brought my stack of history books in so I could show you some of them. But some of them are, there is an attempt at chronicling, but I think in the mentality of the people writing things down at the time, they did not have that clear distinction between fact and myth.
Right.
And so that's why you get this challenge as a modern historian when you know that some things, you know that there aren't magical spears and things floating around the storyline. So what really did cause this and cause that? Right. That's the challenge.
Because that's interesting, because in the West, you know, we had a fairly strong tradition of specifically, I mean, the ancient historians, for example, not even before Rome, the ancient Greek historians, in fact, Herodotus himself, of course you get things that are obviously legendary or mythical, but he quite often will say, I don't think this is true or real. But certainly by the time you get some of the first century Roman historians, people like Tacitus, or first century AD, or people like, say, Tacitus, they're almost entirely modern in their view of, they're trying to attain the truth, trying to see through the tangle.
Of events. But I think this is a difference, again, in Eastern and Western philosophy, actually, rather than history, in that, well, Western philosophy is strongly founded on the Greek school, I think it's fair to say, the sort of Stoic ideas of the supremacy of the mind and the rational intellect as being better than the base instincts of humanity. And so it seems to me that the challenge for an intellectual there, a philosopher, a historian, a writer, is to really overcome this mess and write down that accurate example. And the more that you're using your mind and the less that you're using your body and your other senses in a way, the better your work is likely to be. Whereas in the East, they don't have that. Their Buddhist tradition is very much more about the integration of the emotional and intuitive side of the mentality with the more rational side of it. And I think that's where this distinction, this hard distinction where Western philosophers attempt to erase the feeling of experience from the recorded facts, doesn't happen in Japan. And that's why you get a much more mythical retelling, I think.
Right, yeah. So just pure, being purely selfish here, from a modern's point of view, that's not really ideal, is it? I mean, it's valuable in a different way. But let's say sort of a modern historian, what you're looking for is...
You're looking for good facts, not good
exactly,
stories.
Exactly, yeah. You're looking for things that are sort of solid ground that you can start pinning other things around. That sort of... So, for example, you take the Iliad or the Odyssey, and they're a piece of literature, but they're also extremely valuable historically, but not as like an absolute... fact, you know, it just points that it speaks more about the age of when it was first written down rather than the events themselves, which depict a much more ancient time. But to get back to England, to talk about
it's an eventful time, the early 1000s, isn't it?
Well, I was just going to say as about our historiography side of it, we've got people may have heard of the Venerable Bede, Bede, the monk of Jarrow. Who wrote the ecclesiastical history of the English people. And he wrote that. He died before Lindisfarne happened even. But you can buy a Penguin paperback copy of Bede. It's very, very quaint. I find it funny even sometimes because he'll just say one line. And not really explain what any of it means particularly. But it is quite clearly, quite obviously, beyond doubt, a proactive attempt to record historical fact, whatever that means. And then we've got sort of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. There's more than one version of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. It's not just one thing. There are a few different monasteries or houses around Britain that kept their own version, and they have slightly different takes on things. But anyway, we've got the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, and if we are talking roughly about the turn of the millennia, we also get there's a life of Emma of Normandy, and then there's a life of Stephen of Blois, and of course the Doomsday Book. Because if we talk about populations, for example, I wanted to ask you. We don't really know what our population was exactly before Doomsday. After Doomsday, which is 1086, is Doomsday, so towards the end of William the Conqueror's reign. And it's in fantastic detail. I mean, unbelievable detail. Yeah. As I mentioned earlier,
I've got a copy at home. It's incredible.
Have you? I've not got a copy.
It's fun to just read, to leaf through and look at different places, especially if there's some connection, if you live there or something. Just say, oh, what was this place like 1,000 years ago?
Yeah.
You opened it up. So William of Warren had 3 cattle worth 10 guineas. Fabulous.
As I say, it lists individual, like the individual livestock. Like this guy's got 8 pigs. And 10 chickens and one horse or whatever. It's unbelievable detail. So as I said earlier, where the modern...
There's the Great Domesday and the Little Domesday, isn't there? Domesday in even more detail?
Yeah. Incredible. And in fact, we now know that most of it was taken from earlier Anglo-Saxon records. And they just sort of updated it.
Sewed it all together.
And and in fact, there's other examples after Doomsday Book of the same thing, because it's not the first one. They're not as famous. But like, I think William the Second, Rufus, and his younger brother, Henry the First, they also commissioned, Henry the First, I'm pretty sure, commissioned another Doomsday Book. And it's, but it's just not as well known because it's not the famous thing, you know. So what we do have in the world, in England, is still not a fantastic, it's not a wealth of information, but suddenly the Dark Ages are illuminated a bit more. Doomsday casts a great amount of light on the turn of the millennia England. So I suppose, again, there's a bit of a difference there with Japan.
Well, in Japan, they do take censuses. Okay, their administration is based on a very strange interpretation of the Chinese model. And they have a system called the Ritsuryo system set up in the Nara period before Heian begins, where they're already surveying and working out who has what where, so they can tax it. Because much of the very early history of Japan is the history of rice taxes and getting rice, basically robbing it from the... tax isn't theft. Taxing it from the peasants. And there's a fabulous quote that I've heard once, and I haven't been able to track it down, which is something like, the ideal peasant should be taxed halfway between starvation and rebellion, or something like that.
Gosh.
But basically, they take that rice from them, and there's this very elaborate system they have to work out who has what and where it is. They also have the Koseki system at some point coming in, whereby they record everyone and their family lineages. And this is especially important, of course, for the genealogy of the nobles. But I must admit, I don't know too much about that right now. I haven't researched it in preparation for this podcast. But this is one of the ways in which we start to get some light shed on what's going on in Japan and what's where. There's a funny instance that happens, and I can't remember if this is before or after the Heian period, where because of a loophole in the way that the census is collected, a load of farmers start reporting themselves as being women instead of men, because that way they can dodge the tax. There's lots of things like this, or they sign up to the protection of a shoen, which can be like a monastery or a noble's mansion, which has become tax exempt for various political reasons. So that means they don't get taxed, and then they pay a small fee to the local shoen owner so that he puts them on his books.
Right.
So basically you've got an incredible amount of accounting crime, which is just painting a picture of early Japanese society.
It's funny, a parallel there is a striking one, now you say that, is that the Doomsday Book is the same thing. William the Bastard wants to know exactly what assets he has or hasn't got in his new kingdom. It's all about that. It's not just because we want to record things or like a love of bureaucracy. It's all about the money. So that's an interesting parallel there. And again, I do believe that people would try and fiddle it if possible. If you can just, when the guy, literally the human comes round to see what your small holding is and what you've got, you try and hide your stuff.
One period where the taxes were so onerous and the census so poorly collected that peasants were just literally upping sticks and abandoning their farms so they could move to somewhere else where they wouldn't get tracked down, things like this. Incredible, isn't it?
It's interesting, isn't it? Among the earliest things that organized human civilizations communities do are tax money. It's all to do with taxes.
Tax peasants and dodge taxes.
Amazing, isn't it? Yeah, the only thing you can be sure of is death and taxes. What's that cliche from? I can't remember.
Was an Ambrose Bierce quote, was it? Was it Mark Twain?
Sounds right. You mentioned the year 1002 because there was an event in England, in 1002, the St. Bryce's Day Massacre.
Oh, right.
And anyone who might not know what that is that Ethelred, the Unready is king at this point, and he decides that he orders every single Dane in the whole land to be murdered, extrajudicial killings, all at one time, all on one day. I believe it was in November or towards the end of the year of 1002, he orders that. It's sort of a bit of a crazy thing.
Yeah.
It didn't actually, it wasn't actually able to be carried out because vast swathes of the north are, York at that point, I believe, was under their control. So it would have been an actual genocidal type level of thing had it been carried out fully. Which it wasn't, but it was still bloody. It was, lots of massacres happened. So again, where we talk about the parallels where Japan was, it sounds like, enjoying relatively stable, just politically speaking, we're still in the absolute craziness times of crazy swings back and forth.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.